So hey guys, this is the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast about movies where I sit down and I talk with a film lover every other week to find out their story as to how they fell in love with film. And these past 2 weeks, before I get into talking about this episode that we're going to be doing, I feel like it should be a thing that I do since the last episode where I finally came back from like a 2 month hiatus, that I kind of poured myself into the intro, into this interesting thing, and you guys responded to it, and I'm like, how do I do that more? How do I pour myself into this show more, into giving you myself, in if that doesn't sound weird enough yet. As to be like, this is what I've been feeling for the last few weeks. I feel like I'm stealing from the king of feelings on podcasts here, Mr. Mark Maron, who loves to do his intros where he's talking about his cats or about how he ran into someone that week and it made him feel a way. But god damn it, I'm gonna do it anyways. I hope he doesn't sue me because I have no money to give him. I told you guys a couple weeks ago that I started a new job, and wow guys, it's been an interesting experience with this new job. It's very weird for me because while I consider myself, like it's not a fact, I am very much so a very young man, and very young in my work experience so far. I have only had these experiences in corporate culture, where everyone you talk to, everyone you interact with within corporate culture is always there kind of just at you with a very calculated feel, where instead now I'm working in this new office where it's a very small environment and it's dedicated development. It's not like everywhere else where I am the one IT guy in the building, or I am one of two people who are working in IT, and I'm the guy who gets phone calls, who gets, why is Windows not working? I just messed up my cup holder on my computer, and I scratched my head as to what the hell is a cup holder on a computer. Please tell me, guys. And I know the answer, and I refuse to give you guys the answer. You guys have to figure that out for yourself. But it's really weird for me because, like, the moment I walked into this office, I got this really odd feeling of family that these guys are giving out to me, and I'm not sure how to accept it because I'm very used to, as I said, the corporate idea of work environment where everyone is cold, calculated, some in nefarious manners, some not so much, and it's just about being efficient. And coming into this family style of development where it seems everyone in my office understands the idea of development, instead of me having to shout at them, this work is gonna take some time, I need time to do what you're asking me to do, they're very much like, oh yeah, we know, here is every tool you'll ever need to do the job we're asking you to do, and we want you to be nice with us and enjoy working here. And it's kind of a shock to me. I don't want to jinx it yet, but I think I like there. I think I do. It's a challenge, and I'm working towards it, and I hope in a good way that it doesn't ruin the time I spend on this website in being a place that I can create and conduct and make content for you guys. Because I really hate, if there's one thing, while I enjoy the work I do, because it's an exercising work for my mind, which is one of the things I love about the profession I work in. I really do not like the idea of it becoming to the point of me not having any time to do anything else, including this website. And I hope it doesn't really interrupt with what I'm doing here. Because, in all honesty, and you guys have noticed this, as I mentioned in my intro from the week before the last episode, I am kind of pulling back on the amount of work I'm doing on the website because, guys, I don't think I have it in me. I don't think I have the drive in me to do the daily article writing that some people are doing. And as I mentioned, I don't think I was creating that great content anyone needed. I kind of am happy so far with the last couple weeks of content. Doing a couple shorter reviews, doing an article where I was kind of just thinking about what I saw in movies, as opposed to writing out a 400 word review that was like, this is the movie, please keep it in this box in your head, as opposed to being like, let's talk about this general idea in movies, and you guys should go and read that article talking about the idea of, what was it? It was the idea of how you agreeing with the core argument of a film can kind of hurt your enjoyment of it. And I think it's working. I like it. I hope for a lot more people to be joining into the discussion and see how that works. I'm still playing around with a new theme on the website as well. But yeah, that's kind of what's been on my mind this past couple of weeks, and I just wanted to share that with you guys. But remembering once again that this show isn't about me, it's about my guest. I should mention the fact that my guest on this week is Mr. Edward Douglas from over at ComingSoon.net, otherwise known as the Weekend Warrior. He's on to talk about the 1985 classic Terry Gilliam film Brazil. So I hope you guys enjoy. Go follow him on Twitter. He is at EdDouglasWW. Let me make sure that is correct, because I totally make those mistakes. He is at EDouglasWW, and go tell him you were listening to this podcast and you enjoyed this conversation or not. And you can go and read his articles over at ComingSoon.net. So enjoy the show, and here we go.
The rules of the game are laid down. We all have to play by them.
Look at you, Sam. Whatever happened to you?
An empty desk is an efficient desk.
Let a friend tell you. Your life is going wrong.
Now shape up!
Do cooperate. Think of your mother.
Has anybody seen Sam Lowry?
Sam, it's time for you to grow up and accept responsibility.
You'll never get anywhere in a suit like that.
Yes, yes, yes.
Sam, what are we going to do with you?
You must have hopes, wishes, dreams.
No, nothing. Not even dreams. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what I want.
Can I say, it's been a long time that we've spoken, and I have been wanting to have you on my show for so long, but I've been tentative about it. I've been kind of like, I want to give him space to deal with all the things you've been dealing with for the last few years before I brought you on here. And I'm so happy that you're here, and I'm so happy that you're here to discuss this quite unique film. But before we get any further, I like to always start at what I consider the beginning of all of these stories. Tell me about the first time you actually saw Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Were you a theatrical?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, back in 1985 when it came out, I won't say I was a huge movie fan. It was really weird. It was, I was 2 years out of high school, just to kind of give you my age. So basically, I graduated in 1983, and I kind of I didn't really leave. I was in Connecticut, Westport, Connecticut, and I kind of just stayed there for 4 years before I decided what I wanted to do next. So it was one of the movies I saw. I mean, I had a job. I probably went to the movies. I don't know, maybe two or three times a month, but maybe not even that much. I was not like a big movie guy. At least not after high school. Because when I was in high school, I used to hang out with friends and go to midnight movies and stuff like that. But the thing is, I know I saw it in Connecticut somewhere. I would not remember which theater. But I was a huge Monty Python fan. I mean, I have been a Monty Python fan since I was at least 10. So I would watch all their movies. I was always interested in, you know, I saw Time Bandits. I was definitely a Terry Gilliam fan from his time with Monty Python and his time directing. So when this movie came out, it was just like, oh, there's a new Terry Gilliam movie already. I was already knowledgeable enough about him to see it. I don't remember exactly where I saw it. I'm not sure if it even had as big an impact on me when I first saw it as it did years later. But
I'm curious about this because this movie is one of those movies which is infamous for having numerous versions throughout the years.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing since you saw it theatrically, you would have seen the shorter 90-something minute version of this movie.
And you know what? I wish I could tell you the answer to that because I don't think I did because – no, I don't think I did because it's funny because I've seen – I remember when I was in New York already, which was in 87, which is maybe like a few years later, sometime within – I have to say within 10 years because it was between the time I was in New York and the time I got my first DVD, which was Brazil, that it was in sometime during that time where I saw it at the Film Forum, the extended version. And I don't remember ever seeing a shorter version. Like, I feel like I've always seen because I don't know if you've seen the documentary about it, but I feel like they did release the longer version. At least where I saw my movies, I'm pretty sure I saw the longer version because I saw the full. I think they cut out. You know, I'm sure it did because the ending was always the same. I've always seen the same ending.
Okay.
So yeah, so I've always seen the same ending. So it's got to have been the long version because I think they got rid of the end, the very very. Kind of the fake out ending kind of thing.
Supposedly, because honestly, at this point, I have still yet to see the shorter version of this movie. I only know of it as the subtitle that people have dubbed it, Love Conquers All. And
right.
People say they just literally chopped off the last 20 minutes and some, like, I watched this movie this week, watching the longer version, and I sit there almost as interested in the idea of there being a shorter version, which is happier and has a different tone to it, watching this movie, trying to imagine what that could be, and I can't imagine it. Like,
yeah, me neither. I feel like, from what I understand, and again, I, if I've seen this 90-minute version, from what I understand, they've cut out a lot of the fantasy sequences, which is what I really love about the movie. I love those fantasy sequences, and that's kind of shocking to me that they might even do that, because I feel that's really a very uplifting part of the movie.
Yeah. So we're talking about Brazil, a film which deals with a lot of issues, including, I think, something that most of the British understand a lot more than many other nations and cultures, the idea of government ineptitude and disguising it as red tape. I'm kind of curious, as a youngster coming out of high school and as you grew older, how did some of the more cultural aspects of this film play for you?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head there, because that's the thing. When I saw it in high school, or actually after high school, so I was about probably 20, 21 maybe when I first saw it. When I saw it then, it was just kind of like a really entertaining movie with fantasies. It was very funny. It had the humor of Python I liked. It had, you know, Michael Palin from Python who I liked. It had a lot of stuff. I mean, it had a lot of things I enjoyed about it. I enjoyed the kind of crazy, all-over-the-place thing. But then over the years, a lot of that stuff about the government kind of like really struck me. And then after 9/11, I mean, just the whole thing was just like, holy crap. This is like, you know, they saw this like, you know, whatever it was, 20 years earlier, they saw how America was going to be, and even England too. They saw that, you know, there's going to be like the government constantly watching everyone, you know, constantly, you know, there's going to be terrorism. There's going to be, this constant thing where, and people make mistakes and people end up in prison and they become persons of interest for no reason whatsoever. And all that stuff was just kind of like 20 years earlier. And of course, I mean, in England, they had the whole NRA thing and they already had terrorism back then. So there was already that aspect of it. But I mean, you know, watching it even 20 years later, it was just like, wow, they really saw a lot of stuff that just came true, you know, in a big way. And it lasts, a movie that really lasts and plays well now as it did, you know, when I first saw it, I think.
You are kind of right talking about the predictive nature of this film, the way that Gilliam kind of observes society and idealizes a way that he sees us going. And kind of picks the darkest timeline for us to kind of be like, you realize this is what we're doing. And it kind of made me think of another film. I'm not quite sure if you're familiar with it or what your relationship is with it. Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, of course. That's definitely, I probably saw that maybe around the same time or a little bit after that, yeah.
Being films that talk about social issues, talk about the way that we interact with technology, I'm kind of curious what you would kind of say to someone who would be watching these films, Videodrome, and like this today, where we are currently existing in the future those movies are talking about.
Oh man, that's really interesting because it's funny because in 83, it's funny because I love the technology because there's a lot of stuff I love about this movie. I mean, it is my favorite movie of all time. But I mean, the technology. For instance, you watch this movie and you see the technology where you have this typewriters and attached to a screen, and you think about that compared to today. And I'm really curious whether people watching the movie for the first time, with smartphones and all this other stuff, we're just looking like that's ridiculous. It's kind of like seeing a science fiction movie from the 30s or 40s and stuff like that, and or 50s, and seeing what they think the future is going to look like compared to what it is now. It's just like it's one of those things where it's kind of hard for me. I still enjoy it. I get a kick out of it. I don't know whether a lot of younger people would get past that. I mean, again, I have a relationship with this movie because I saw it when I was, younger and I was 21, when I was very, when a movie like that can really kind of, say, oh, that's a really cool movie. But then, over the years, I've got to know it more for a movie that's really kind of insightful and smart. But, it's hard to say. I don't know. I haven't talked to a lot of people who know the movie or have seen the movie who are younger. But I do have to say that I was able to borrow a DVD from someone who I just knew loved movies enough to have it in their collection, and they did. So,
we're talking about the technology in this movie, and it is something that's kind of prevalent when we talk about science fiction films, that we always try to imagine what the future would be like, always keeping in context what technology is like today. So a lot of 80s films, which did a lot of futuristic things, everything wanted to look like it was so angular. And the thing that I found so interesting about the technology in this film was the fact that all of it, one of the prime things that technology has done over the years is its prime function was to make everything smaller. While Terry Gilliam forgot that fact and was like, everything's going to remain the same size. We're just going to find a way to fit it all in. and I found it massively interesting to see things like that in this movie. I mean, there's nothing more entertaining to me than watching Palin's wake up in the morning and all of the things in his apartment start to kind of get going for him.
All right, right.
And I don't know why it's this one thing for me, but there's the part where you see the bathtub and the stopper comes down off of the from above. And it's as if they didn't realize that maybe we should put this thing down here since this is where it's actually supposed to be. And I'm not sure whether movies like this were made intentionally to satirize an idea of a technological lifestyle, or if it was just that they couldn't imagine what technology would be, so they were like, fuck it, we're just going to do it.
It's funny. That's definitely a question I'd love to ask his production designer, who I don't know who it was, but I mean, it's funny because when he did 12 Monkeys, it was more than that. It must have been like 15 years later. He also showed the future, and it was the same thing. He has this kind of like vision of the future, even like 15 years later, which is just like, very makeshift kind of, it's interesting. It looks less technological. Less technological than it actually probably was that time.
Definitely.
If you understand what I mean, it's just like it feels like he ignores the technology and just kind of says, well, in the future we'll just like jury rig all this stuff together.
Just throw everything in the room and make it work. We don't care.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
One thing, keeping on the technology binge with this movie that I noticed, and it has to do with what I kind of imagine is very, very apt for how our society kind of runs today, in that it's not just that we adopted technology and we, in order to interact with technology, we created this binary, this binary language which we talk to technology with, where everything has to be yes or no, one or two. But within this movie, it feels almost that they adopted that language to talk to themselves. Hmm. And I kind of like to point to the sequence in the restaurant with Michael Palin and his mother and the maitre d' trying to take his order.
Right.
And he's just refusing to take the idea, I want steak. He has to hear the number.
Yeah. I feel that's a very French restaurant type of thing, a very snobbish. Like, I think that's probably like I think that's something that probably Terry Gilliam probably experienced himself. Like, he probably was in a restaurant and they probably had numbers next to a Chinese menu, and they said, they really wanted him to say the number. That seems like a very, even for 83, that seems like a very like present day thing.
Really? I understand the idea of it being a convenience in restaurants and in stores to be like, okay, I know I can't read this language, so just give me that number.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, for someone to completely reject the idea of them just saying the name just seems a bit level higher than following a convenience.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, waiters in restaurants have always been kind of snobby, like, especially high-end ones. Have always been kind of snobby, and I could see that being the case in 83. I mean, especially if Terry Gilliam was probably getting, taken to a lot of fancy restaurants, being wooed by studios and stuff like that. I'm sure that must have come from some experience he had.
Talking about the idea of this film, when you mentioned earlier that certain aspects kind of grew in what you were looking for in this movie. You started out talking about the idea of being a fan of Monty Python and the weird, dry sense of humor, which is just riddled in this movie.
Oh, there's like, yeah, I mean, there's lots of, like, watching it again, like, every time I watch it, there's, like, scenes which are, like, completely, they really have nothing to do with anything. Like, for instance, he's driving down the street and you see those big nuclear towers, which you think is just kind of a landscape, and then some drunk guy kind of, like, hovers over them. like every time I see that, it's kind of like, that's, like, there's no point for that scene whatsoever, but it's something funny about that and something very Gilliam-esque about it in some ways, yeah.
One thing I purposely did this time rewatching the movie was I intentionally stopped the movie every time I saw a poster or an ad in the background, and I started reading all of the text in them.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And there were some really, really great ones where there was one, for example, in the alley where the children are playing, you see this poster of what looks like a vacation out on a boat somewhere, where it's like, have vacation panic free, where there is no terror. And I'm just like, that is your selling point for a vacation in this world. That is amazing.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's exactly – and again, that's exactly the kind of, like, cynical humor that kind of, like, it's – I mean, he had that already in Time Bandits. It really kind of permeates a lot of his work over the years. But that was, like, definitely, to see a vision of his future, what he thought the future was going to be like based on, what London was like, or England was like that at that time. It's like, yeah, it's very telling of Terry Gilliam.
You mentioned the fact that One of your favorite aspects of this movie has to do with the fantastical aspects. I'm guessing you're talking about a lot of the dream sequences where he's flying about and there's this giant Japanese armor fighting him with fire flaming out of it and such. What is it that you see, I don't mean definition-wise, but just what is it that kind of drew you to that aspect of this movie more than possibly the others?
Well, I think, I mean, again, when I saw it when I was younger, I mean, I that was around the time of, Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was the time of the, Empire Strikes Back. It was definitely, I mean, as a younger person who just likes, that kind of big epic fantasy action, I mean, I kind of like that. And I like if you watch this movie now, it's like, there are problems with the movie. It's not like, I mean, there. It's not like, there are shots and edits which are kind of like not great. It's not like one of those movies you watch like, oh my God, there's a cinematic masterpiece as far as the visuals even, But I mean, there's something about, back then when you see it, when it's like you're just blown away by what you're seeing. That we're seeing this fantasy world. It's very distinctly from the mind of Terry Gilliam. It very much is like if you saw the animation he did for Monty Python, it's very much in that vein, but done live action. So it was that kind of thing, the kind of cross between like the fantasy and the action. I'm really big on that. I mean, I don't know if you know, but I was a huge fan of the remake of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and I got to get a lot of ribbing for that as well. But, but I was a huge fan of that. And I kind of like that. I'm kind of like that as a person. That I kind of, you know, I think a lot of people see me as a very realistic, down to earth kind of person. But I'm very much constantly just thinking, fantasizing about like what if, you know, other things. And those kind of movies do kind of really, I really can relate to them, and I could relate to them. 30 years ago, and I can definitely relate to them now for the same reason. So that's probably why those scenes had the most immediate impact to me, you know, back then.
It's kind of interesting that you bring up the Walter Mitty comparison, because regardless what people think of that movie, talking about the dream sequence aspects, the thing about Walter Mitty I found is that while it bases itself in a reality where you can see that there's a road, there's buildings that seem real, it's very easy to find that point where the world feels off and you kind of are just thrown into this dream sequence where Walter Mitty is saying, what if I could surf roads? And he goes off and he surfs roads and you have this weird moment. In Terry Gilliam's films, especially this one, you have these dream sequences where as it starts, you know this can't be real. But then as we go further into the movie, and especially with the director's cut that we're talking about, the idea of it being ending up being all in his head that he kind of inserts into the end of this movie, where you have to start and go back into the movie and decide where did the all in his head story start and where did the reality end. Do you find it challenging or enjoyable to kind of have a movie make you question reality, the reality of its own story?
It's interesting. Well, I got to just say one thing really fast. I actually interviewed Ben Stiller for Walter Mitty. And I actually mentioned the fact that I'm a huge fan of Brazil and said I was half expecting that movie to end with like the last hour of the movie of Walter Mitty being just in his head. I was expecting it to go that way, which would have been very, very dark. But I mean, it's funny because I don't think I ever – like the first time I saw Brazil, like I don't think I saw the ending coming. I don't think – I really thought – like I really was thinking, okay, we're getting into like, you know – like, you know, I felt like maybe there's something, maybe there's some kind of cross between, like, in his head between what's really going on with his fantasy world. But, like, I gotta say, it came as a shock to get that very ending when it says, you know, oh, we've lost him. It's like, I mean, it came as a shock to me, you know, but not in a bad way. I thought it was just like, wow, they really got me. They really, you know, made me believe in this, that it was gonna be this huge happy ending and it was all gonna be exactly like he dreamed. And, well, no, that's not how the world is. That's not how the world is, you know. And you know, and it had that probably had a huge impact on me also, because as a young guy, you're thinking, you know, oh, the world is my oyster, everything's gonna be great. And then they think like, well, you know, or maybe not. Maybe it'll be, maybe someone will fly an airplane to the Two Towers, and then we'll all be, you know, taking off our shoes and giving up our water when we go on airplanes. You know, it's like, yeah, you never know. It's interesting to kind of like have this movie where it says, yes, it's going to be this great happy ending, and no. Yeah.
All right. I really tried to stay away from this, but since you keep bringing it up.
Are you talking about the ending? Or?
No. I'm talking about 9/11.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
There has been a slate of movies recently, which the internet likes to dub as post-9/11 movies, where people like to comment on it. And while I don't want to take away from the conversation of movies discussing 9/11, I find it kind of interesting that this keeps coming up in a conversation about a movie that came pretty much, I don't know the math right now, but let's say 3 decades before 9/11 actually occurred. Do you, as someone who I'm assuming that event affected very closely, do you find yourself looking for allegories into what you see in a change of your world pre and post 9/11 in movies very often?
I would say not so much. I mean, I think, you know, again, I was literally about a mile away from the World Trade Center. I mean, I used to be able to see it right from my apartment. I'd be able to look out my window and see it. I mean, it was very much, you know, it was part of my life. I mean, I was there that morning. I saw, you know, some of what was going on from a mile away from my rooftop. But like, I don't think I look for it that much. I mean, I think I'm maybe more sensitive to it than others, maybe just because of my proximity. I mean, but like, I don't think about it every day. It's not like that. It's like, it's just sometimes when something is in a movie, when it's kind of obvious or where it doesn't get something right, or it's kind of like, you know, using it in a way that's not like, I don't know. It's hard to say. But what's interesting that you mentioned that, though, is that, I mean, I think, to be honest, I think Brazil is more in effect. It actually almost goes the other way. You saw Zero Dark Thirty, right?
Yes, I have.
Oh, yeah. There's a scene in Zero Dark Thirty where Jessica Chastain is having a meal with, I think it was Jennifer Earle, just some other woman that she works with, and they were just having a nice little meal together, right? And no lie, I watched that scene, and for some reason that scene reminded me of the scene in Brazil, and that was before the explosion in Zero Dark Thirty. Because there's a similar scene in Brazil where they're having a nice thing, and then there's a huge explosion. The same thing happens in Zero Dark Thirty, except somehow I foresaw that happening only because for some reason that scene reminded me of the scene in Brazil. I don't know. I don't even know why. So I kind of like foresaw the explosion in Zero Dark Thirty before it actually happened, just because I'd seen Brazil and remembering some kind of – it was weird. It's like Brazil seems to have more of an impact on me when I watch movies than 9/11 in some ways. But I do – I mean, I think I do – I'm a little more sensitive to 9/11 just because, you know, I do remember what New York was really like, and I remember, you know, I was here for that week. And I think a lot of people who do movies about it weren't actually here, and they're kind of doing it, you know, from secondhand in some ways. So,
do you take a movie to task, especially movies coming out at this stage, which directly try to comment on that event?
I'm trying to think of the last one. I mean, there was a really good documentary about the Cantor Fitzgerald Company, and how they, you know, were affected by that. And no, I think it's, you know, again, I don't think it really, I can't think of anything in the last, like, maybe 3 or 4 years that I've really just completely taken to task because of that. Because it's not, yeah, it hasn't, I really don't feel it's been, I mean, there was a movie that I kind of felt like, there was a movie with Michael Shannon, I can't remember what it was called. I think it was called The Missing Person or something, where they kind of used that as sort of like a really awkward kind of, like, they use 9/11 as kind of a really awkward kind of, like, plot device for a movie. And I thought that was kind of, you know. But, I don't think I've really taken anyone to task about that, you know. But again, like, watching Brazil, it's hard. Again, like I said, there's so many elements of that's kind of hard to ignore about that. And especially the way the government reacted to 9/11 and how, people were persons of interest and the way they in the Patriot Act and all that stuff, which is just right out of Brazil. So,
I mean, perfectly. I mean, because this movie plays with the idea of rounding up people and just blanketing it behind we don't want terrorists in our world and giving up freedoms just because of it, which is pretty much the direct relation to 9/11's tale and what's happening afterwards, and people kind of doing this give and go as to what they're willing to give up and what the government is kind of fighting for versus, and it's a weird little thing that's going on over there, and that's why I live in Jamaica.
And the funny thing about Brazil is that this whole thing and the humor of it is that it starts with a mistaken identity. It starts with someone, you know, swatting a fly, getting a letter, you know, getting someone's name wrong, and you know, the guy dying when he's interrogated. And it's like, you know, that's the kind of thing where it's just like you can see that happening. You can see like someone making a computer error and someone, you know, getting the wrong person. You can see that happening. It's like not like. It's not that unfathomable, you know, for that to happen.
So, as someone who was as deeply affected by this movie as you are, I'm kind of curious as to how it's played with you as you share this movie with your friends and family, or.
I don't really. That's the funny thing. No, I don't. It's really weird. You think I would, considering how much I love it. I mean, I think people know. You know, it's funny because when I first went into the hospital last year when I was first diagnosed, and I was there like for like a month at a time, I did – a friend asked me what my favorite movie was, and I told her Brazil, and she sent me a DVD of it so I could watch it. But, like, I've never actually, like – I don't know. It's really strange. I've obviously have so many movie friends and people I talk about movies all the time, and I don't know. I mean, I think I mentioned it from time to time. I don't think I've ever, like, said, oh, we have to watch this, you know, so much. Because I don't know, because a lot of my friends are younger, and like I said before, I get a feeling they won't love it as much as I did because they don't have the, you know, they don't have the background. They don't have the, you know, it's weird. It's strange. I think it's funny. Like I can kind of tell when someone will be a fan of it or not. And I think the people who are fans of it have already seen it. And the people who aren't, I don't know if I'd want to try to convert them and fail. So,
I mean, that is a weird, awkward experience when you try to get someone into a movie, especially a movie like Brazil, and you can just feel their seething hatred for the movie coming across the room. You're like, yeah, this isn't working.
Yeah. I mean, especially women, because, like, I haven't dated much in a while, but, I mean, when I dated women, it was like I would kind of know. I mean, it's like I knew this was my thing, and it's not, you know, maybe I'd watch it with them one someday, but it was never – became, you know, never would be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get a woman into Brazil, because I never really think that would be the kind of movie half of them would like, so to be honest. So
that would be the crux of some romantic comedy out there. She loved Brazil, it's done, we're married now.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess if they had a Brazil conventions, like they have like Big Lebowski ones, and I met a woman there, I'd probably marry her, probably.
like you'd know from up front, we're okay with this bit.
Right, exactly. We're okay with that being. But the thing is, it's funny because I'm not like with Brazil like some people are with Star Wars. I mean, obviously, I mean, it's my favorite movie of all time. I love it. If anyone asks, I mean, I doubt it'll ever be replaced as that in that spot at this point. But, yeah, I'm not like Star Wars where it's like I don't have, like, you know, posters up everywhere and, you know, stuff like that. It just is what it is.
So I know we decided to make our conversation today about Brazil, and we've gone into a lot of other things. We've gone into New York City. We've gone into 9/11. You even half mentioned your stint in the hospital. But there's something you mentioned in your email when I first told you about doing this that I told you I was probably going to ask you about. And you said to start off that the film you would have naturally chosen After Hours was a film that was taken. And you said that you would have chosen it primarily because it was a movie which inspired you to move to New York City.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious as to what kind of process that happens, because After Hours is a movie which I kind of dub as nightmarish.
Right.
And I'm not saying Scorsese hasn't had his stints in making New York look amazing, but that movie kind of makes New York look like kind of a pain and the kind of place you might not want to be. How does a movie like After Hours make you want to be in New York?
You know, it's funny. I was raised in New England. I was in Massachusetts and Connecticut. And I mean, I did come to New York. I mean, it's funny. After Hours came out the exact same year as Brazil, by the way. I can't remember the month, like the month wise, but I mean, it came out the exact same year as Brazil. It was interesting because I mean, I've been to New York a bunch before, obviously, but I watching After Hours, it was just kind of like I thought that is the craziest place in the world. If any of this is any even possibly realistic, like possibly authentic, it's the craziest place in the world. It's much more interesting than Connecticut, that's for sure. And so I kind of became enamored by that New York, by that kind of like underground downtown. And it's funny because when I moved to New York in 87, which was 2 years after both those movies, in 87, I mainly stayed downtown. I really was once I got a place downtown, I never went above 14th Street. I was definitely one of those like downtown people.
So you're saying you aren't the person who comes downtown and has the nightmare. You're one of the people who enact the nightmare.
Yeah, I'm one of the weirdos that they meet on their exactly. But that's where I kind of enjoy. When I came to New York from Connecticut, though, I mean, I think when I was in Connecticut, I was already getting by like 80. By the time I graduated high school, I was already kind of. I mean, I was a goth of like in 83. I was already a goth. I was already wearing black. All the time. I wear black. I don't know if you know this. I've pretty much worn black pretty much for the last 30 years. I don't think I wear color once in a while, but very, very rarely. So I wear black all the time, and I was pretty much been the same since 83. So I was like that before I moved to New York. So I was kind of already kind of an outcast, but when I saw After Hours, I was kind of like, yeah, these are my people. I should be going to New York because that's where all the weirdos are. And of course, by the time I moved here, it already started getting gentrified, and it was started getting a lot. I think a lot of the cool stuff about New York was gone by the time I moved here, which kind of sucked. I see a lot of docs like about early 80s New York, and I'm like, oh yeah, I really missed out.
Oh, so you're doing the nostalgia thing where everyone tells you it was better, and you're like, I think you're right.
Well, the thing is funny is better is subjective. I mean, better was like, you know, I mean, I'm talking about movies like the one about Plato's Retreat. Yeah, I wouldn't be going to Plato's Retreat when I was 17, I'm pretty sure. And there was other movies like, there's a movie called, like, I think it's called No Wave, which is about the music scene. And I was into a lot of those bands, but like that No Wave really kind of tapered out by 87, 88, and it started getting more commercial. Sonic Youth signed to major label and stuff like that. So, but still, yeah, I mean, After Hours was a huge influence on that. There was another movie called, it was a John Sayles movie called Brother from Another Planet. Have you ever seen that movie?
No, I have not.
The Brother from Another Planet, which is basically just this, basically about this black guy who's an alien, but he just looks like a normal guy. And it's a strange movie, but it was like very, there's scenes in that movie to this day have a huge impact on me. Like, you know, like I can remember the scene so distinctly, even though I haven't seen the movie in at least 25 years. And, yeah, so there's movies like that. I mean, there's something very glamorous about New York, you know, in movies that I saw in movies in the 80s and from the 70s and stuff like that. That kind of made me think, yeah, I should go to New York. That's where I'll probably fit in better.
I find it very odd because, as far as my understanding of American culture, there is a need to individualize yourself. While at the same time you talk about this idea of fitting into this individual world where everyone has to loudly say, I am the weirdo.
It's true. It's funny. It's absolutely true. I mean, I don't think – I mean, obviously I have my groups of friends.
No, I mean, like everyone does.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. But it's like, there's definitely a – maybe not so much these days. I think it was more – I think, the 80s and 90s maybe – you know, I think it's definitely become less that way. But, yeah, no, there's definitely a thing about being an individual in New York, being, you know, independent. It's something which, you know, yeah, I feel like that's more here than other places I've been, you know.
I mean, even the world Brazil touts. I mean, that's the world – the English culture is all about being together, being one, which is what they keep talking about in that movie, which boggles me as to how this movie hit you so well.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it is still very – I mean, I feel it's – because you watch the movie, is like you feel like even though this big – the production design is big and it seems they have a big, big, big scale. I mean, most of the scenes have two people. There's not a lot of scenes with like more than two people on screen together. You know, there's a couple with like three maybe. But it's always – I don't know. It's very – I don't know. It feels very focused on Sam. And I feel like he is kind of individual in that – in this world where everyone accepts the fact that the government is, everyone seems to accept the problems with this world, with their environment, and you know Sam is one of the few people who doesn't, and Rob De Niro's character Harry, I think it's Tuttle, Harry Tuttle doesn't accept that, and they fight against it, they do their own thing in that world, very much so, and even Jill, even the love interest Jill is kind of like that too as well. They're you know, they are, you know, trying to be individuals in that world where it's just accepted that that's the way it is.
And I'm kind of happy for that until it brings me one of my favorite moments from this movie. I think it's the one moment that I remember from my first viewing back. I always pick this moment, and it's the moment where Robert De Niro is lost in papers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that is basically the idea of the world I know, which is the world that no matter how individual you are, there is a system which will wipe you away.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've never really worked in that kind of I've had my experiences. I mean, I don't know if you know, I was a music producer when I came to New York. I was doing, you know, music production engineering, and I was working like just a, I mean, I've had maybe twice in my life, you know, post New York, where I worked for like a corporation, where I worked for like a big company like that, and one of them, oddly enough, was during my tenure at Coming Soon, where I was actually like just. I had to get a job. I was basically not making enough money Coming Soon to do it. So I basically took temp work at a place called Standard & Poor's. Do you know what Standard & Poor's is?
No, I'm not familiar.
Standard & Poor's is like a Wall Street company, and they kind of rate other companies for their bonds. And they basically give ratings to companies for how good their bonds and stocks are. And it was just like a temp job. It was not like – I have no experience with Wall Street or any of the market or anything like that. But basically just had a temp job, data entry. But I was in a cubicle. I was in a very similar environment as the one in Brazil for the first time ever. And it was, you know, it was a big company, and I had a bunch of supervisors who would kind of assign me work. And they realized I worked for a web company, and they said, "Oh, we should have them help with our redesign of our website." And yeah, I know exactly. Like, I'm sorry,
world. I laugh because that's my job.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I know. But the thing is, you probably know how to do that. I don't. I assume you don't. I just write for a website. I know. But the thing is, so what happened is, like, I was in this environment, which was the closest I've ever been to that environment that Sam works in Brazil. And I actually took a couple meetings with some of the supervisors talking about this website. And I just sat there quietly, and I realized these people literally have no idea whatsoever what they're talking about. Like, the guy was saying, "Well, can we have it like some text where we click on it and then it goes to another page?" And I'm like, "You mean like a link?" Like, it was it was just very, very odd for me to like be like not the most knowledgeable people about websites, but being in a similar environment where it was really obvious the supervisors didn't know what they were doing or talking about, and you just had to kind of sit there and go like. Okay, you know, and they were coming to you for questions because they just didn't know what they were talking about, and that's exactly what the relationship between Ian Holmes' character is with Jonathan Pryce in some ways, you know.
I love the way how Ian Holmes gets frightened when work appears. He's like, "I don't know what I'm doing."
Yeah, exactly. It's really funny, and he also kind of wants to have deniability. Like, he wants to be able to like have someone else, you know, get the blame if something goes wrong. Which is such a, you know, it's funny. It's such like a, again, I haven't worked in that many environments like that, but I love Office Space, and Office Space seems to kind of propagate that same, it seems to propagate that that's the way it really is in a 9-to-5, you know, suit and tie world. It's like, which I've tried to avoid as much as possible.
And I congratulate you on avoiding it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. I mean,
cause I dream of it, and I hope someday soon I can avoid it too.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta say, I mean, I'm very lucky to have the job I have, and unfortunately, it is still kind of corporate. Where I doubt they'll ever listen to this, but I mean, there are people at the parent company who once in a while I'll get an email forwarded to me from my boss, and be like, "Are you kidding me? Do they really not understand how anything works?" Like, you know, stuff like that. It's just like I let my immediate boss. Buffer me away from that, so I can just worry about movies and not worry about any of that stuff going on.
That's the best kind of gig, and that's
yeah, it is. It is. I'm lucky to still have it. I'm lucky to still have it.
Anyways, I think we're coming to the end of this conversation as it stands, and I'm kind of curious because I always like to ask everyone, like, talking about. You already mentioned the fact that it's a movie that you don't quite always share with everyone because you feel the people who are going to love it already love it. And the people who aren't going to love it, you better not waste your time with them because that's just a harsh experience.
I'm not sure if I'd say I wouldn't waste my time with them.
As in sharing that with them. I don't mean as in not interacting with them. I didn't – sorry. My problem.
Yeah, I know. No worries. I mean, I think, yeah, I understand what you mean, but I think there's some people, you know, I mean, I think there's some people who I would, you know, say one day, like, "Hey, have you ever seen this? You know, check it out." You know, but I have, you know, I think a lot of people who I know have seen it already know it. So yeah.
Yeah. What is it that for someone today seeing this movie for the first time, do you hope that they catch on immediately?
Oh, what people seem to see today, what they'll catch on immediately. I honestly just hope they I mean, if they haven't seen a movie by Terry Gilliam, I hope they'll, like, you know, go and try to find some of his other movies, like Baron Munchausen and 12 Monkeys. And because I think Terry Gilliam is kind of, he's kind of, I mean, there's obviously people who still love his stuff, but I feel like they've kind of, you know, I think the people of a certain age probably don't know his stuff because he hasn't had anything even approaching a mainstream wide release in many, many years. So if anything else, I think they'd hope they'd watch and go like, wow, this is a guy, this is a filmmaker who has a really distinct vision of the world and how to capture it. And I want to see what else he's done. Because, I mean, not everything he's done has been great. He's had some real big missteps over the years. But I'm a huge fan of his filmmaking and his sense of humor and his, you know, I mean, I like him as a person. I've met him. I've got to interview him a few times. And I really like him as a person. So, I mean, I guess if nothing else, I hope they'll come away from it saying, okay, I want to see more of this guy's vision of the world, you know, whether it be fantasy or more reality-based or whatever.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for talking with me, Ed.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I love this movie, and I don't talk about it as much as I probably should.
So that was the episode. I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank Edward for joining me. I mean, he's a great guest. I hope you didn't get confused by our speeches, our tones, because he is kind of quick and I'm not that quick. I mean, I can be, but I think I kind of tone myself down when I go on mic because it just feels natural for me to talk like in a really clear way. And I don't want to say Ed is unclear, but you know, he's quick. Like, I feel like he is too New York for me, where he is moving at the speed of light and I'm like, I'm just kind of calm here. But anyways, go and read his work, as I said, over at comingsoon.net. Go and follow him on Twitter, at edouglasww. And as always, go and rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can go and look for it. Just search for the Movies We Love podcast, or you can search for my name, Andrew Robinson, or you can find a link for it in iTunes over at my site at gmanreviews.com in the post for this show. You can follow me on Twitter at GMRReviews, and as always, always, guys, please keep loving me. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy. Wherever I go, in the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lone